6 seconds left. Hallett gets it up top. Marcius over to the right. Big shot! Score! Shai Theodore! Vegas takes the lead 4-3! 2:03 to go! Perron to the circle. He shoots and scores! David Perron wins it! Up top for Kopitar. Feet to the right. Shot! Stopped by Fleury!
Shai Theodore is fourth and a huge hit by McNabb. He leveled Arvidsson. Wow.
Here's Howell into the zone. Howell left side, drop pass, big shot, score! That's John Merrill! Merrill puts Vegas on top, 2-1!
And welcome in Vegas Golden Knights Insider Show. Clayton Hamilton, Frank Harnish, Ryan the Hockey Guy Wallace, Chris Chapman behind the board today. Very big show. Golden Knights got off the schneid against Calgary. They continue the winning streak against Vancouver. 4-1 victory last night. But fellas, it came at a price. Marc-Andre Fleury with the injury, only played the first period. We'll have a lot of updates today on his condition.
Yeah, and right now we don't know how big the price is, whether it's just taking him out for precautionary reasons. We do know that Marc-Andre Fleury will not be joining the team on their plane today up to San Jose. Coach Gerard Gallant said that he may join them tomorrow or sometime in the near future, so they haven't really let a lot of information out about it. There's a lot of speculation, a lot of stuff on social media, a lot of people saying what they think they saw or what they know. Bottom line is none of us knows for sure, but it does seem like they're trying to keep this stuff a little bit under wraps a little bit, or maybe they're just trying to protect everything until they know 100% what's going on. But we don't know that much more, unfortunately, than most of the people out there.
It was a weird press conference, wasn't it? It was like, what about Fleury? What's going on with Fleury? Well, not much. He's maybe going to travel today, maybe tomorrow, maybe in the future, maybe sometime he'll take a plane somewhere that may be where the Golden Knights are playing. And then Amber Dixon says, is he injured? And Gerard Gallant gives us the biggest piece of information that hasn't really been confirmed yet. Yes, he's hurt. So we know that there's an injury. We don't know if it's upper body. We assume it's upper body. We don't know if it's lower body. I don't think it's lower body. But we know there's an injury. We know that Marc-Andre Fleury was injured in a game against the Vancouver Canucks when you're 8 points up on the San Jose Sharks for the division lead after starting 21 of 22 games.
And he only played the first period. Malcolm Subban last night saying that he found out midway through the first period that he was going to go in.
Yeah, and you know, the one kind of strange thing here that unfortunately is getting lost in all this is Marc-Andre Fleury did move into 12th place by himself by passing Chris Osgood last night with his 402nd win. However, that is certainly the secondary story because everybody wants to know what's going on with Marc-Andre Fleury. We want to know. I'm sure the team wants to know. I'm sure Marc-Andre Fleury wants to know. And maybe nobody does 100% know, but they certainly know more than they let it out. But you know what? I can't say that I completely blame them either because the NHL doesn't say that you have to give out every single piece of information. And Gerard Gallant basically said it when Amber Dixon asked him that question. And he said, look, I'm not going to give you any more details on it. And that's pretty much the way it's going to be.
Yeah, I guess when he's ready, he'll be ready, which is fine. But we don't have any timetable. We don't know the extent of the injury. We don't even know what the injury is at this point. But what was it like on the concourse yesterday after Fleury went out? Because I can tell you what it was like up in the press box. Everybody was scrambling, trying to figure out what was going on. A lot of people were speculating it was rest, which didn't make any sense, obviously, because Marc-Andre Fleury wasn't on the bench. If you're going to rest a guy, you put him out there because at least then, like we saw with Malcolm Subban, he goes down for 7 minutes because he's got a skate issue. If Marc-Andre Fleury is healthy and Marc-Andre Fleury is ready to go and available, Marc-Andre Fleury's back in the net. And that kind of dispelled the rest thing. But what was it like on the concourse? What were the fans chattering about?
There was a lot of questions about it being rest. Rest didn't make sense to me simply because it's out of character for Gerard Gallant to have pulled him even with a 3-goal lead in the first period. Like, if he was going to rest him, you would think that it would be maybe the third period or partially way through. But it was out of character for Gerard Gallant to make that kind of decision. So there was a lot of question as to where is Marc-Andre Fleury? What is happening? What is the update? Most of the people were just asking us, and we were like you guys trying to scramble to figure out where he was.
And what's funny about that is rest really didn't ever fit the narrative, because what's the difference between 20 minutes?
Right.
Like, if you're going to rest him, you don't rest him after 20 minutes of gameplay. You rest him for the full 60.
Well, I could kind of see it. It's like, okay, I didn't necessarily think it was rest for Marc-Andre Fleury. I was hoping that maybe they thought, we have a 3-0 lead. Malcolm Subban hasn't been in there for a while. Vancouver's not playing well. So maybe it's a chance to get him some reps, get him a little bit of time on ice there, and maybe in the same day make it a very easy night for Marc-Andre Fleury to rest him a little bit, not have him play the full 60 minutes out there. That's what I was hoping. That's what we maybe thought even into the second period when I'm listening to the call and you're hearing Gauthier say it on TV and Dan Duva talking about it on the radio. But then when he wasn't even on the bench for the third period, that was the eye-opener. And that's when, as we were getting ready to go to Under the Beer House, because Clayton and I do the post-game show down there, I did have a couple of people stop me on the concourse, including one of our listeners, but some listening for years, Irv, came up to me, and he asked what was going on, and I said, what do you mean? I didn't know that he didn't come out to the ice because I'm getting ready to go out. And he said, yeah, he's not even on the bench. And I'm like, well, then maybe there is pause for concern here.
And we're going to find out a little bit more about concussions. We're going to have Dr. John Petrick from the Las Vegas Pain Relief Center. He's coming on with us in just a couple of minutes to sort of go through what the concussions are, concussion protocol. That's what we all think it is, given that the only real spot that we could see where an injury occurred was taking a puck directly to the mask. So we will check in with Dr. John when it comes to that. But we know a history of concussions when it comes to Marc-Andre Fleury. That's the kind of thing that affects your travel, that affects your practice and whatnot. And we do have Dr. John Petrick from the Las Vegas Pain Relief Center on the line with us now. Welcome, Dr. John.
Hi, guys. Welcome.
It's good to talk to you. Unfortunately, we always seem to catch up with you when somebody is feeling poorly, and that is the case certainly with Marc-Andre Fleury. Announced today by Gerard Gallant, he is injured. Most of us are looking at it from a concussion angle. That seems to be his history and his pattern. Can you walk our audience through just what a concussion is and what are the steps to treating them?
Well, concussions are obviously very, very something that should be taken very seriously. There's some differences with the NHL versus other leagues that I'll go through it a little bit too as well. But concussions really comes from the Latin word, means to shake, and literally means to kind of shake loose. So what happens is that the brain, which is a soft tissue, made out of soft tissue, and it's cushioned by the spinal fluid, and it's encased in it like a protective shell called the skull. When a person sustains a concussion, the impact or the jolt on the brain creates some confusion in the brain. It literally causes it to move around in the head. So it is what's considered, concussions can be considered mild, moderate, and severe, and it's ultimately their symptoms that can give them that diagnosis. So depending upon the symptoms of each particular person suffering the concussion is what differentiates it from each individual situation. So with the NHL, there's some differences, and one of the biggest differences that we have is that the team, the teams and the trainers and the players are the ones who ultimately make these decisions. So they're kind of changing some things up in the NHL. They're adding some other positions and things like that to kind of be able to spot these concussions, see these people when they're on the ice.
In looking at concussion spotters, especially when it deals with goalies, should any puck to the mask be considered a possible concussion, and should a player then be removed from the game?
Well, you mentioned spotters. So the league just had, there's three types of spotters. The newest type is what's known as a central league spotter, and that's in the home office in New York. And they're watching every single game, and they're watching for suspected possible concussion injuries. Then you have your in-arena spotter that sits up in the booth, and they're also looking. And then you have what's known as the on-ice official, and they're the third sponsor. So right now, they just kind of took the handcuffs off of these officials that when they notice a blow to the head, they are changing the rule that as soon as they notice that a particular type of blow, like they estimate that blows to the head from a stick to cause concussions are about 1%. That means that they don't happen, but they do occur. So they know which particular hits to look forward to or look for. So at that particular time, the on-ice official can remove a player at that time.
Does the job of the spotter change depending on the player that he's dealing with? For instance, somebody like Marc-Andre Fleury, who's had four concussions, do they watch him closer, or is he under a different microscope than somebody who doesn't have a history of concussions?
I wouldn't say necessarily that they're watching him closer, there is a tendency once the skull is injured from a traumatic injury that once you're concussed, you can be concussed more regularly, and sometimes those concussive symptoms can last a lot longer. So they would pay attention to Marc-Andre more. There's something called CTE, which is chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And what that means, and this came out really big with the movie Concussion, and that is when these guys take these concussions over and over and over again, they actually start creating some holes inside the brain. And, you know, every league is trying to prevent this. Nobody wants to have their athletes or their players injured, especially not permanently for life. But someone like Marc-Andre, they will be searching to make sure that he does not develop that CTE. So, yes, now each player is pretty much handled the same way. They're supposed to be removed from the ice. They're supposed to be assessed in a quiet place. But a lot of times that doesn't necessarily happen. They also perform a scan. It's called a SCAT-5. And that SCAT-5 is a various different. Some of them would be, for instance, with the SCAT, it's a specialized standard tool for evaluating concussions. And it's used by physicians primarily and licensed healthcare professionals. It's not something that you're going to see that you want to use a trainer or a coach to assess. You really do. These concussions assessments really need to be done by a medical profession and not not somebody else that doesn't really know what they're doing. So you got to have the medical professional. But you're going to look at for various different symptoms. I mean, this is not something that takes 10 minutes. The SCAT-5 test, what's known as, as I said, it's the sports concussion assessment tool. It takes probably a half hour, 45 minutes to actually go through this, if not even longer, depending upon the severity of the condition.
So I guess the question then is, if there are three spotters paying attention to every game, why aren't players being taken out of games?
Well, that's because the discretion is ultimately left to the league. So that's a huge problem that they're having. But here's the thing, and the truth is, in all fairness, the league is in a difficult spot, because particularly when it comes to goalies, because it's an enormous amount of pressure from the player, the coaches, and the team, ultimately. So when you're pulling a player from it, you better make sure that that person does have unfortunately have a concussion, because you don't want him to get back there and then him be able to come, you know, have negatives on all of his concussion tests, and you just pulled a player from the game. But it's in other leagues, it's a medical director that actually pulls the player from the ice or from the field. In hockey, it's one of the rare sports that it's as long as the league gives the teams, the trainers, and the players the discretion, you're going to see guys staying on the ice. Now, that's changing. That will be changing. There are some of the rules that will be changing again with that new spotter that they created, that new Central League spotter. As soon as they see it, they can talk directly to the in-arena spotter and then the on-ice spotter and say, get that player off the ice. There are some things that the NHL can do. I think it's smart if they do them. I think again, they could come up with some equipment changes. I think they need higher penalties for these players who are repeat offenders. So when you hit somebody, and you know, we all know that they're like the NFL's done, is they kind of monitor the hits to the head. They monitor this. So the NHL needs to kind of follow that and come up with some harsher punishments for these repeat offenders. They need to look at this, because it's not just the concussion today. It's like Marc-Andre Fleury. What's happening to Marc-Andre when in 5-10 years from now? We all seen what's happened in the NFL. So, really, there is no reason why. It comes down to the discretion of the player, the coach, and the team trainer. It should be held, responsibility should be held by a medical physician at that time. And, I mean, are you familiar with some of the things that they'll be looking for? And I could go through those if you guys need to.
We know that he'll go through a number of tests to make sure that he gets to his baseline and come back. And like I said, just to be fair, we have not been told any definitive reason that it is a concussion, that is an upper body, that it is a lower body, that we've been told nothing, which is another problem when it gets to the NHL level of disclosure of injuries. We don't even sure what we're exactly looking for. We just saw him take a puck to the mask last night, and with the history that is given, that is certainly the first thing that came across our minds.
They're going to be looking for some red flags, Clayton. They're going to be looking for some neck tenderness, double vision, weakness and tingling in his hands and feet, severe headache, seizures, loss of consciousness, deteriorating things, vomiting, increasing restlessness or fatigue. Sometimes they get very, very, very irritable, and there's nothing that they can do. They're looking for observer signs of this. They're looking for these signs. And then they go through the memory assessment, which is known, actually the memory assessment is called the MODOX questions. And it is, can you do the dates and times? Do you know where you're at? Can you do the months in order? And then once you get there, you go to something called the Glasgow Coma Scale, and that's an examination of how they're doing. Are their eyes open? Are their eyes concentrating? Are they fluctuating all around? Those types of things. Then you do a cervical spine assessment, and you're just making sure now that there's nothing in the spinal, even though the brain has been concussed, there can be injuries in the spinal column that you have to assess. And then there's really the athlete's background, and then there's a symptom evaluation that we have to go through. And these are all these little things that you're wanting to see. I mean, basically, you got to pull that athlete completely from the activity. They can do absolutely nothing until they pass all of these neurological screens, until they do their cognitive screens. And if they don't pass, they don't go back on the ice, period.
Now, I know we've talked before, and you've mentioned that concussions, the symptoms can be immediate, or it could take a couple weeks or more sometimes to develop. Is it possible to put somebody through these tests and they pass them and then the symptoms come up later on or something like that, so you could still miss it? Or is this stuff so intense and everything that they would, as long as they pass them all, they are okay?
Well, in healthcare, especially in sports, nothing's 100%. There is that opportunity that these can be missed. I mean, like you said, you got three spotters in an arena, and they can be missed. And and that's why it's very important to get it out. And I'm not trying to disparage any particular athletic trainer. They're some of the greatest, smartest individuals I've ever met. But when you're going to CYA and you're going to put the responsibility on someone, if it was my player worth that much money, I want the best. So I would like a medical director to be able to diagnose that and put that pressure on them to pull my athlete as opposed to an athletic trainer. Even though most of them are pretty much qualified, you still want to have that other level of specification in there that I feel is needed personally. But yeah, unfortunately, they do go on. A lot of times trainers will fast track the exam. And they don't do a thorough exam, and they're so. And again, we're talking game time situations sometimes. So to go out there and to do a full assessment, it could take 15, 20, 30, 45 minutes. Well, that's half the hockey game. So a lot of times, what happens is these players can't get back on the ice until they've passed it. Can they stand up? Can they balance? Are they falling over? What are their physical capabilities? And that all needs to be displayed.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. It's Dr. John Petrick from the Las Vegas Pain Relief Center. And hopefully next time we talk to you, it'll be under better circumstances. But as the story develops, I'm sure we'll talk again.
All right. Thank you so much, guys. I hope I helped.
All right. Thank you. There's Dr. John, Las Vegas Pain Relief Center, LVPRC.com. Go there. Take your first step toward feeling great. But, yeah, guys, that's going to be begging the question moving forward. How soon can Marc-Andre Fleury get back? What is going to be the official diagnosis from the team doctors, from the leagues, from the medical professionals, all of those folks that have to decide on what exactly is going on with Marc-Andre?
Well, there's one other interesting part about this you have to remember, too. Because Marc-Andre Fleury is a goaltender, he's unlike any other player on the ice. If somebody on a line or something gets hit in the head and they show concussion-like things, they can skate over, they can take them down, they can immediately do the assessment. With the goaltender, if you even think that, you basically have to stop the game, you have to take them off the ice and replace them. We see players go down all the time for an injury or something, and they might come back once they covered or something. But the goalie position is the one that's on an island by himself out there. So I don't know. I don't want to say that they're a little bit more hesitant to pull him off right away or check him out, but they don't have that same immediate availability, because to check them out properly, you do have to literally remove them from the lineup.
And to be fair, that is what happened. I mean, if that is the case, that things did. We're deteriorating after the hit to the head, and we all know that sometimes with the adrenaline, with the number, that those symptoms and those things don't make themselves readily available. But we did see that with Marc-Andre Fleury, that he came out and apparently is going through all of these procedures.
Sure, yeah, exactly. I mean, he had 18 minutes to go through whatever tests he needed to in the intermission, because he did finish out the period in the first period. So, I don't think we're going to get very much.
Mm-hmm.
Gerard Gallant basically said we're not going to get very much. He said that there's not much I'm going to give you. And their focus right now is on the healthy players that are with the team and getting the X beside their name to get into the playoffs. That's their singular focus. And to an extent, it has to be.
Mm-hmm.
You got to focus on what you have at hand. Fortunately, you have a goaltender in Malcolm Subban who this year has proven capable of playing number one goalie minutes. Hopefully, with a couple of very big divisional games coming up against San Jose tomorrow and then next week, Malcolm Subban is up to the task.
Well, they did climb to 99 points with the victory last night, and part of that was because of our play of the game. Our play of the game turned out to be the game winner, Cody Eakin, streaking through, picking the puck out of the air, and knocking it home. The play of the game brought to you by a Best Mattress. Best mattress, best service, best selection, best price guaranteed, Cody Eakin.
Theodore shifting his way in. Markstrom will poke it away. Score! That went in off the body of Cody Eakin. And the Golden Knights with two quick ones.
And upon further review, he got his stick on that, a beautiful bunt job. But the play, as so many times made by the guy before, Shea Theodore getting into the offensive zone, the beautiful drag to create the opportunity.
Yeah, and you know what? Kudos to Cody Eakin and game-winning goal for him, as it turns out, with the end of the game, because Vancouver did get their goal as well. So Cody Eakin's been he's had a lot of success here. And I know he's taken some flack from some people and that on social media and different places, but I think he's played his butt off, and I think he's been a nice addition to this team. He comes up with a big face-off for different things when you need him all the time. He might not be the flashiest player on the ice, but he plays his butt off.
I disagree. I look at Cody Eakin and I say flashy, flashy, flashy. The guy doesn't score a regular goal ever. It's always off the head or off the skate or bunting it in the air. I mean, the guy is just flashy, oozes flash. I think Cody Eakin is fantastic.
And he certainly has played well in given that he's had a bunch of folks around him, defensive-minded, up to 10 goals on the season, so good on you, Cody Eakin. But our player of the game was a guy that we were waiting to get back onto the score sheet. He had been away from it for a while, and that is Jonathan Marchessault. He got the first tally of the night. He is our player of the game. Player of the game brought to you by Brankus Team Realty. Your home sold, guaranteed. Jonathan Marchessault.
McNabb to keep it alive. Carlson looking at a Marchessault, and he scores! Jonathan Marchessault puts it off the post and in, ending an 11-game drought. It's 1-0 Golden Knights.
And Jonathan Marchessault getting right to the happy zone. He loves to score from there. It's a goal scorer's area on the ice. William Karlsson found him. He buried it.
Yeah, and that one was just, by the way, 57 seconds before Eakin had the second goal there. So they scored in quick succession. That's something that we haven't always seen this team do, but when they're successful, sometimes they do. And Marchessault, nice to see him get back there in the scoring column with that goal. And, you know, we know how dangerous the Vegas Golden Knights are when they score the first goal of the game.
It's weird to see William Karlsson set up Jonathan Marchessault. It's usually always the other way around. It's good to see Marchessault get back into it and score a goal. The guy is heart and soul for this team. He really is.
Certainly good to see that top line flying and back again. So 4-1 is your final. That's going to close the book on Game 73. Tomorrow we'll be back at it in San Jose. 6:30 for the pregame show, 7 o'clock for the puck drop. So join us right here on Fox Sports Radio. And remember, when the Golden Knights win, you win too. Be sure to listen to us here at 98.9 FM, 1340 AM after every Golden Knights win for your chance at a $50 gift card to MJ Christensen Diamond Jewelers. We are going to give that away right now. Caller number 6, you get that $50 gift card. When we come back, Keith Gave is going to join us. He's the author of The Russian Five, a story of espionage, defection, bribery, and courage. We had him on Monday to talk about the portion of his book when they were in Russia. We're going to talk about the portion of it right now with them in Detroit. So give us a call, 702-876-1340, 702-876-1340 for your shot at MJ Christensen, Vegas Golden Knights Insider Show. Fox Sports Radio, your home for Golden Knights in the Valley.
Knocked away to the left wing boards near side. Yanked around the rim, McNabb. Centering feed, score! Marchessault! Off the pipe and in. Vegas strikes first. 4 minutes into the first period. Here comes Theodore down the middle, on goal, and a poke check made. Rebound goes in! Cody Eakin on the doorstep, forced it through. A weird deflection in front of Markstrom, and the Knights take a 2-0 lead. Reeves in the right side to the right circle, centering feed, a shot, they score! Belmar fires from between the circles. Markstrom got a piece, but not enough. Right circle, Schmidt threw it across the net mouth. In front, stop, another try, score! Tatar, 4-0 Vegas!
And welcome back, Vegas Golden Knights Insider Show. All the goals from yesterday's 4-1 victory over the Vancouver Canucks. Clayton Hamilton along with Frank Harnish, Ryan the Hockey Guy Wallace, Chris Chapman behind the board, getting ready for tomorrow night as the boys head to San Jose to face the Sharks. Well, we are really happy to have author Keith Gave back with us. He was here on Monday to talk about his a book that came out yesterday, The Russian Five, a story of espionage, defection, bribery, and courage about the Russian Five and their impact that they made on the NHL in the city of Detroit. Welcome back, Keith.
Clayton, Frank, how are you guys doing today?
We are doing well. It's really good to talk to you. We had an interesting story on Monday, and there's more to get to today. Let's jump right in. A little bit about you. You spent 6 years in the United States Army as a Russian linguist, working for the NSA during the Cold War. Got to go and write for the Detroit Free Press. Got to know a lot of the Russian hockey players. When last we spoke to you, they had all sort of gotten their way out of the Soviet Union and made it to the United States, but they had yet to assemble in Detroit. So let's pick up right there. Slava Fetisov was struggling a little bit in New Jersey. Igor Lirionov languishing in San Jose. And then the idea came to get all these guys together in Detroit. How did that come about?
Well, one guy deserves all the credit for that, guys, and that's Scotty Bowman, the renowned coach. He was here, had a pretty good team. He knew he had a good team. Three good young Russians, Steve Yzerman, Nick Lidstrom, a really good team that seemed to get to a certain place and plateau. Couldn't seem to get anywhere in the playoffs. He knew one thing from coaching against Russians earlier in his career, the Soviets, I should say, and that's that they like to play in five-man units. So I'm sure it was by design, although he says it wasn't. He went out. You're right. Slava Fetisov wasn't playing much in New Jersey in the 94-95 season, and kind of a healthy scratch much of the time. So he went to the wings. His partners, in when it comes to the executive leadership of the team, Ken Holland and Jim Devolano, who was the senior vice president at the time. You know, hey, I got a chance to trade for Fetisov. I want to trade him. Well, what does New Jersey want from him? They want a third-round pick. They said, a third-round pick for an old defenseman who's not playing in New Jersey? Are you kidding me? And Scotty held his ground, and they wound up giving up that third-round pick for Fetisov. Comes to Detroit, becomes a pretty good player right away for this team. And, you know, then they faced New Jersey in the springtime in the Stanley Cup Finals. Fetisov's old team, and Detroit gets swept in the finals by a really good New Jersey team, by the way. And Scotty knew he had a little bit more work to do putting his team together. So in the fall, he had a chance. So he went to Holland and Devolano and said, "Now I have a chance to get Igor Lyonov. I'd really like to get him. You know, we need another centerman." And they said, "Well, okay, but what does San Jose want from him?" "I'm going to give him Ray Shepard." Well, if that name rings a bell to you, it's because at one time Ray Shepard was the best goal scorer in the league for about a 2 or 3 year period, a couple of 50 goal seasons, one of them in Detroit, almost scored at will for a while. And that's when, you know, it created quite an angry debate between those three guys. And Scotty finally put his foot down and said, "Look, you brought me here to win. Do you want to win or not? I want to trade for Lirionov." They acquiesced and let him make that trade. They got five guys together, and then the magic happened.
Keith, I know when we talked last time, you had mentioned that although all the guys came over here and it was kind of separate, it wasn't like a big move where they all talked to each other. But once they got here, would they have attained the same type of success they had if they didn't all play together in Detroit, where there was that comfort and they could at least speak to each other and they kind of had that camaraderie of knowing that they all came over here, although they came over in different ways? Would they have had that same success if they came over and they were all spread out all over the NHL, in your opinion?
Well, I think they would have. They're talented enough players. They absolutely would have. You know, that Scotty put them together that night in Calgary, and they dominated the Calgary Flames and changed the league and the game forever in North America. You know, we saw something special. But you could take Igor Lirionov, as Scotty often did, and put him between Brendan Shanahan and Martin LaPointe. You had a pretty good line there. You could put Steve Yzerman at center and Sergei Fedorov on his right wing and have a pretty dangerous power play unit with those two guys on it. These guys were world-class players, every one of them, and they would have had success no matter what, as we're seeing with Russians today. You got, Tarasov in St. Louis Kucherov in Tampa Bay and so on. They don't have to play with four other Russians to be pretty darn good.
You know, the thing that I think is interesting about that is you talked about Scottie Bowman being the guy that brings these guys together. Typically, that's a general manager's job. So was this kind of Scottie Bowman's defining moment, his chance to really put his claim on this team and what they would eventually become?
Well, I think so, to a certain extent. You know, Scottie is an absolute, maybe I can argue, the greatest coach of any sport, professional sport ever. With all those Stanley Cup rings. But he wasn't particularly a great general manager. He spent 4, 5, 6 years in Buffalo as the general manager there, and his team went backwards in the standings every year that he was there. So he didn't really build much of a winning team there. He came to Detroit, and one of the stipulations was that he would have some voice in personnel. So they let him have. He was essentially the coach and personnel director. He could move guys up and down from the minor leagues and back and forth, and he could make trades. The deal was Jim DeLuano was Mike Ilitch's confidant, and basically said, Mike, let's give him some leeway, but keep him on a short leash just in case. Well, they let him make some moves, and he traded away some guys that didn't really fit in around here. And brought the Russians in, brought some other big players in. You know, he was instrumental in making another big trade at the start of the 96-97 season, traded away Keith Primeau and a number one draft pick and Paul Coffey for Brendan Shanahan. And Brendan Shanahan, we talk about the Russian Five a lot, Shanahan might have been the final piece to the puzzle.
You know, it's interesting because a lot of times people say that sports and politics shouldn't intermingle, but they certainly did back then and they certainly do today and they always will. I know one of the things that it says in the review of your book, it says the Russian Five did more to bridge Russian and American relations than decades of diplomacy between the White House and the Kremlin. Can you touch on that a little bit, exactly what that meant, not just in the sports world, but in the whole realm of Russia and United States and their relationship?
Well, that's my opinion there, guys. As somebody who kind of fought on the front lines of the Cold War a little bit in West Berlin and got to know the Russians from sort of both sides of that line and getting to speak with guys like Slava Vitisov, especially Igor Larionov, the two older Russians, Sergei Fedorov to a certain extent. These guys came to see, again, having lived on both sides of the Iron Curtain, grown up in the Soviet Union and coming to America, and we saw in those guys that, hey, these Russians are not only bad people, they're actually pretty good people. They're great hockey players. They're coming over here to America and thinking, you know what, this is a pretty good country. Everything we learned in the Soviet Union about how bad Americans are, that's all wrong. And Fetisov especially, and maybe he may be one of the most important politicians in the world today. He's a senator in the Russian parliament, very, very close to Putin. But he understands the importance of sport as diplomacy. He wants to keep the games continuing in terms of, young teams playing, young Russian teams playing against, North American teams in Canada, the United States, and so on. He believes that people, can come to greater understanding and appreciation of one another through sport. And, we saw a little bit of that when he was Minister of Sport in Russia and helping to bring the Olympic Games to Sochi and so on. He has very, very strong opinions, and he can share them with one of the most powerful men in the world, Vladimir Putin, and maybe, his views will mean something when it counts most to all of us.
Heath Gave, author of The Russian Five, A Story of Espionage, Defection, Bribery, and Courage, joining us on the Vegas Golden Knights Insider Show, Fox Sports Radio. And when you look at what these five gentlemen meant internationally in terms of politics and whatnot, what did they mean in terms of the style of play in terms of hockey? There was a lot of dump and chase, a very different game before they got here. Do you see their footprints on the way that the game is played today?
Well, there's no question about that. You ask anybody in the game today, anybody in the game on both sides of the
the Atlantic, and they'll tell you that, you know, that the Russian Five and what they did in Detroit had an immense impact on how the game was played. Starting in that first game in Calgary that night on, I think it was October 27th, 1995. That night in Calgary, Detroit won the game 3-0. Russians scored two of the three goals. Calgary had eight shots on goal the entire night, which remains a franchise low for that team. Detroit had 25 shots. The Russians had 15 of those 25 shots. They dominated the game. It got, you listen to Brendan Shanahan and Steve Yzerman and Nick Lidstrom talk about what it was like to sit on the bench and watch the Russians play. They would sometimes break out into laughter because they were so good at playing keep away, this puck possession game. You hear that term a lot, puck possession, puck possession. It started in 1995 when the Russians started playing together, and every team in the league has been trying to emulate it ever since.
But like you mentioned, obviously when they were out as a five-man unit, that was something that was easy, but you had to move them around. You had to maintain that momentum. How did they elevate the play of the players around them?
Well, you talk to some of the what I call, you know, the pipe fitters and plumbers, the third and fourth line guys, the grind line in Detroit, you know, gained some renown in those years they were in Stanley Cups. Chris Draper, Darren McCarty, Joe Koser, Kirk Malpe, guys like that. You know, they had to play against the Russians every day in practice. They hated it. They hated it. 45-second shifts, never touched the puck. But they watched. They learned. They learned. If you watch the Stanley Cup winning goal, Game 4 against Philadelphia, scored by Darren McCarty, of all people, he made a move that if you weren't looking closely, you would have thought it was number 91, Sergei Fedorov. It was Darren McCarty making an unbelievable move to score, make the score 2-0, and wound up winning the game 2-1. But it's emulating the things that you see in practice every day playing against those guys that made those players better. As Chris Draper tells a story, his locker room was right next to Igor Larionov. Chris Draper's a fourth line center, right? Those guys don't get a lot of acclaim in this league, you know, ever. But you know, he tells a story about Igor sitting him down and bringing those guys over, those three or four guys who were on that grind line. So, and Igor says, "Hey, look, you guys are good hockey players. You're not just regular fourth line guys. You have skill, and it's about time you started to act like you're hockey players and you're important to this team." When you got a guy like Igor Larionov telling you that, your chest puffs out a little bit. And you start thinking even a little bit better of yourself and your place on the team. It made a tremendous difference to those guys. When Chris Draper tells the story, you almost see tears come to his eyes. What it meant to him.
We've certainly talked a lot about how the Russians changed the game over here, and I think it's a much more wide open game and a fun game to watch. What, if anything, change wise, did the Russian players have to do to adapt to the NHL game and the game over here in the States and in Canada?
Well, you know, they knew that because their name ended in OV for the most part, they were going to get treated a little bit differently by everybody, especially opponents. Opponents took terrible cheap shots at these guys. Referees let them get away with it. Slava Vtisov will tell you stories of, you know, was coming over to New Jersey, being basically outcast by a lot of his own teammates because these guys were coming over here. You got to remember, they're coming over here taking North American jobs away, taking jobs away from good Canadian boys. There was a guy in the Detroit dressing room who, you know, actually said to Jimmy D, the general manager at the time, "What are you bringing all these Europeans over here for? They're taking our jobs. They're soft. You know, we're never going to win with those guys." There was a lot of that around the league at the time. They put up a lot, and it was kind of shameful, really. Not so much the way opponents played them, but the way the referees let them get away with it. It was a tough time for these guys when they first came over here, for sure.
And I just wanted to backtrack really quick to the story you told about Chris Draper and kind of pumping his chest up and realizing he was more than a fourth-line center, that he had some skill. Obviously, the Russians, they played with puck possession, but was that kind of the start of seeing those third and fourth line players as maybe something a little bit more than just guys that go out there and enforce for other teammates?
Oh, no question about it. No question about it. And, you know, that was one of the one of the special things about this hockey team and all the tools that Scotty Bowman had at his disposal, these weren't your average fourth line guys to begin with, and obviously Igor Larionov recognized that. You know, they had speed and some skill, and they scored some important goals in overtime in the playoffs and so on. But you know, you can. No matter how things are, you still always refer to in the media, the newspapers as the fourth line guys, and it's almost disparaging, really. But it was sitting down and hearing it from a guy like Igor Larionov, you know, which is basically that's Russian for Wayne Gretzky. He was one of the greatest hockey players ever produced in the Soviet Union. When you hear that stuff from a guy like that, it means a lot. And these guys worked a little harder at the game, paid a little bit more attention, and became better hockey players, and Detroit became a better team because of it.
All right. Well, Keith Gave joining us. The Russian Five, a story of espionage, defection, bribery, and courage, available in bookstores and online and anywhere where you shop for books. Started reading it last night. Great read. Thanks for joining us, Keith. We're going to have you in over the summer because we want to talk to you about Buffalo and Dallas and the goal that was or wasn't. And we know you were right at the center of that. So we're gonna get you back on before too awful long and share that story with us.
Those two teams should still be playing because that was not a good goal. I feel bad for Dominik Hasek about that one. I was covering for the Dallas Morning News at the time, and the team that I was covering won the Stanley Cup. But I think they should have waved it off and still kept playing.
Plus, we need to get your insight on Gerard Gallant.
Yeah. So.
Oh man. Give him my regards when you see him. One of my all time favorite people. You know. He with Steve Yzerman and Paul McLean, formed a line in Detroit that remains the highest scoring line in Detroit Red Wings history.
Yeah, so lots more to discuss with you. We can't wait to have you back on. But rush out, get the Russian Five, a story of espionage, defection, bribery, and courage. Thanks, Keith.
Thanks, guys.
When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more injuries right here on the Vegas Golden Knights Insider Show, Fox Sports Radio, your home for Golden Knights hockey in the Valley. Welcome back, Vegas Golden Knights Insider Show. Clayton Hamilton, Frank Harnish, Ryan, the hockey guy, Wallace. Fellas, a lot of injuries piling up this time of year. Tampa announces Ryan Callahan will not make the two-game road trip after sustaining an upper body injury.
That's a tough one. Callahan is really vital to that team and their success, so it's going to be a tough one for them to get past.
It's going to be tougher than Winnipeg and Patrick Laine, who also went out last night.
Now, believe it or not, we got an update on Laine's condition during the game in which he was injured, and Paul Maurice actually talked about how long he expects Laine to be out for the foreseeable future. He thinks it's only a couple of games, nothing too serious.
Oh yeah, and Laine, obviously, I just wonder if that means that Alex Ovechkin now automatically wins the scoring title.
But why is Patrick Laine blocking shots? Like, I get it.
Because he's a hockey player.
Stop the hockey player crap, though. You can't say that. He needs to be on the ice scoring goals, not blocking shots. Winnipeg doesn't need Patrick Laine to block shots. That's why they pay other guys to do it. Matthew Perreault, block all the shots you want, not Patrick Laine.
He wants to show his teammates
it's
that he's a hockey
stupid.
Player just
it's
like
so
them.
It's so dumb, though. Yeah.
Maybe he just got in the way.
It could be.
No, he tried to block it. It was bad. So not smart. Not smart at all.
He's got to get the extra Kevlar skate.
At least Steven Stamkos didn't dangerously trip him. He got fined $5,000 for doing that to Morgan Riley of Tampa Bay.
Don't dangerously trip people.
I mean, of Toronto, excuse me.
Toronto. Just regularly trip people.
Yeah.
It's always dangerous.
There's a dangerous trip, and there's
where's Ryan
a
Reeves when you want to talk danger?
Exactly. Well, you know what is dangerous? T.C. Martin, the doctor. He's next.